Adio.
Hey, hey.
How are you doing?
I'm great. I almost started typing it. I'm so used to doing that. I did do that on the podcast earlier. Jonathan said something, and I was like, that's cool as F. I was like, oh, wait, I don't type. I can talk now.
Oh, well, first I want to say this is obviously not AJ.
Not AJ. Better.
Yeah, well, I would say so, because sometimes when AJ's up, it looks like he's going to pass out, doesn't it? Like, it looks like he's going to fall asleep.
I probably look like it with his eye right now, too, so I'm not going to say a lot right now. I feel like I got punched. Well, I did.
Hey, listen, I've had that happen, too. It happened, I think it happened 2 months ago, and he just got me right in the eye with his nail.
Yeah.
And my eye was sore for like a week. It's,
got the contact. The contact rolled down my eye. I was like,
"Oh, really? Oh, wow! Wow!"
So I was just like, "I'm glad I was able to get it out." So
obviously, like I said, this is an AJ, as I'm sure people know by now. And if you don't, well, then you've never met AJ.
Yeah.
So
you need to meet AJ.
Well, yeah. So Chris is going to be my guest co-host tonight because AJ is feeling a little bit under the weather.
Get better, AJ.
I know he had a show earlier. I never got a chance to see it, so I'm going to watch it tonight. But
Anunnaki. We talked about Anunnaki and stuff like that.
Oh, really? So you were saying this is your third one. What was your first one?
The first one I did today was about WrestleMania.
Oh, so you're a big wrestling fan.
Yeah.
Are you?
Sort of. Not as big as I used to be, but big enough. I co-hosted that one.
Yeah.
They just brought people in because it's like the Super Bowl of wrestling. So, you know.
Okay, yeah. And I was telling you before we came up, I went, like, when I was in my teens and early 20s, I was, you know, a wrestling fan. And I went to WrestleMania when it was in Toronto. I think that's, has it been in Toronto since? I don't think it has.
I don't know. I know at least that, once at least, maybe twice.
Maybe.
They tend to go back to the same places if they're making money.
Yeah. And you know, I've met a few wrestlers in my past. I met the Iron Sheik.
Oh, cool.
Great guy. Really, really super nice guy. You know, I know they give this persona when they're when they're up on TV and when they're wrestling that, you know, some of them are not very nice. I've met some other ones too. I met the Warrior as well.
Awesome.
I met Macho.
How was he? How was Warrior?
Oh no, he died.
Yeah, I know. I mean, how was he to meet? Was he?
Oh no, he was great. He was great. I met Randy Macho Man Savage.
Nice.
Another really, really super nice guy. I met Elizabeth that was with him. Really beautiful, attractive woman.
Rest in peace.
Is she still alive or is she gone?
No, she died. Her and Lex Luger, she overdosed with him doing drugs.
Really?
Yeah, they got together at some point.
Oh, I didn't know that. I didn't know that. I've met Hulk Hogan. And the reason I met him is because my parents owned a condo in Florida in Sarasota. And Venice was right near Sarasota. So he was in Sarasota. So we met him at a fast food joint.
That's so cool.
Yeah. So
my list didn't even that long. So
yeah. And so you know, I've met quite a few. There's a bunch of others that I've met too, but to be honest, they were all super, super nice people.
I mean, we could do a crossover here. You could do Chris Benoit sometime on here.
That'd be cool. That was kind
of an odd case with him.
So for people that don't know Chris Bender, if you've ever seen our show, you'll always see that Chris is watching and supporting us. So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, Chris?
A little bit. I always hate this question, but 50 years old. I live in Colorado. I feel like I'm on a dating service.
Like, well, wrestling. Are you single?
I am.
Okay, well, then there might be a girl out there watching that might be interested. So, you know.
I'm available.
So,
yeah. Live in Colorado. Yeah. Big paranormal fan.
Okay.
Met you guys through that, basically, because JK and AJ and then, yeah. Wrestling. I love these crime documentaries. I always loved them even before you guys. If I could show you my queue on my TV, it's just like full of this stuff.
Okay.
So it's amazing. Yeah. I like this stuff. And it's amazing how everything today is just like WrestleMania. Cool. Anunnaki. All kinds of stuff on Ancient Aliens. We got stuff. I got the shirt on. Here, I'll show you real quick. That's the message they sent into space.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what happened when they sent that message? Nothing back, right?
Nothing back yet. I think they're already here, but that's a whole nother story. Okay. And now this stuff. So it's been an amazing day for me. Yeah. So. Yeah.
And now you just, now has it been announced? Are you guys announcing that you are going to be the permanent guest on Talking with the Source now?
Yeah. I mean, they asked me today and told me, yeah, basically he said, you're the host. So.
Good. That would be fun.
I'm the third host. Yeah. That's pretty fun.
So have you done, and I know you're a fan of paranormal, but have you done any kind of type of investigation yourself?
Our house, the room I'm in now, I used to sleep in the room directly behind this closet.
Okay.
Kind of a story slash where I started doing it again. I was sleeping in that room and I heard this door open. I know you can't see it, but the door next to the closet, and heard something walk down there. And then come back and like the door shut. I got up. I was like, did mom get dinner? Did mom, you know, midnight snack? A little bit older, so I worry, of course, you know. So I went out and I went into the kitchen. Cabinets were open.
Oh, wow.
And
really?
the microwave was even open, one of those old push open ones.
Okay.
So, and since then, in this house, I've had bread thrown on the floor in front of me, like a loaf of bread just. Not like it fell off the cabinet, but literally from the back of the cabinet into the middle of the kitchen. And about 2 months ago, I'm a medical courier, so I have, what are they called, coolers. And I had them all stacked up, and they just went flying down the hall.
Oh, wow.
So that's in this house. But that first incident happened about 8-10 years ago, and that got me back into it, which got me – the Abbey in Canyon City is where I mainly go with JK. Not sure if he's ever talked about that or if you've ever heard him talk about it.
No, I don't think so. No, I haven't heard him talk about it. He might. Yeah.
It's an amazing place, 100,000 square feet.
Oh, wow. That's a big place.
I've been there about probably 13, 14 times, had something happen every time I went. Last time, even saw shadow figures. And.
Oh, cool. So are you looking forward to seeing Global Ghost Hunt? Speaking about paranormal?
Absolutely. He's doing it there, isn't he? Isn't JK going there for it? I think that's why he signed up to go there.
I believe he's recording though, and he's showing. Yeah.
He has a major event coming up called Mayhem at the beginning of May, the first weekend of May, and I'll be there for that. So,
what's Mayhem?
It's a giant event. He does the lead investigator there, if you will. He does like a 3-day event. It's a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday morning.
Okay, cool.
So I'll be there Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and probably leave sometime like. Sunday, like at 4 a.m., like I typically
do. You're going to have some shows to catch up. You're going to have some investigations to catch up on. You can spend your Sunday. You can spend your Sunday watching the ones that you missed.
Yeah. And I'll have my own stuff to go back over. I'm looking on here for my last investigation. I have like 30 EVP clips still to go through. And that was from like 2 months ago. And it's just like, it's the part I hate. If it's video, I love it. EVPs, I'm like.
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough. It's tough.
But we got one time. I was with a group. I just got to say this real quick because this one's my favorite one.
Yeah,
we were in the, you know what an abbot is in a Catholic church?
A what? Sorry?
An abbot. The abbot, like of the church.
Not familiar.
I'm sure you've. It's like the principal of the church, if you will.
Okay.
church.
Yeah.
Okay. They have their own bedroom. And of course, women weren't allowed in it when it was that place at the Abbey. This happened at the Abbey. So I was with a group and we told the girls that. And of course, the girls being the girls and defiant, they jumped on the bed. So we're listening through Spirit Box, and it calls her a slut.
Oh, wow.
And then, like, 5 seconds later, calls her a stripper. And she was like, oh, my God.
Nice. That's I not very nice.
She was taking stripper classes, though, to keep in shape. So she was like, that's so amazing. And her husband's just looking at her like. So anyway, that place, I've always had something happen. It's my favorite place to investigate. Unfortunately, bad things are happening. I'm the lead guy there to ask me not to talk about it much, but.
Yeah, there you
so
go.
So I'll have to find new places. But, you know, there's JK here in Colorado and you guys. And yeah, so maybe I'll travel some and see what you guys have. You guys are back east, right?
I'm in Toronto.
Yeah, and I'm sure you have things, and AJ's in Connecticut, and I know there's things there. So
yeah. Well, there's some good places around me. For my investigation, I am doing a car graveyard.
Ooh.
Now people are going, well, a car graveyard. Yeah, well, unfortunately, a lot of the cars that are in this, you know, type of graveyard are cars that people died in.
Okay, I was going to say mobster cars is what I was going to say. So, yeah.
I've already been there. I was there in November just to be shown around. And I happened to do a couple of SB7 sessions. And we captured stuff on the SB7. I'll give you one scenario before we get to the video here.
So we
were walking around and I saw this bus type of, it was like a bus or something like a bus, but anyways, it was red. So I went to the, now keep that in mind. It was red. Okay. So I went around the front, I put the SB7 on the front and all of us are standing there listening to the SB7. And I asked a couple of questions and I go, what is the color of this bus? It said blue.
Ooh.
Well, funny enough, John, who was, I was with a bunch of people. One of the guys I was with, his name is John, who will be there for my investigation when it happens. He went around the bus. Underneath the red, the bus was blue.
Blue. Nice. Nice.
Now, what's really interesting was I said to John, I go, John, go stand over by that car. And he did. And I go, what is the color of that car that John is standing in front of? Now, keeping in mind, he was kind of in between two cars.
Right.
So he wasn't directly in front of the car. So the car that I was hoping it would answer, or it would say the color or whatever, it said yellow. But the car beside it was green. Okay. The car was green, but right next to it, the car was yellow.
Ooh. And he was kind of in between the two. Nice. I like that.
And then there's one point, and I'm not, I think you probably know, but I'm able to see spirits.
Yeah.
So, there was one point we were just walking down just to doing the tour. And then all of a sudden I look to my left. And it's probably about, I don't know, a good 25 meters. I see a spirit right in front of the car.
Woo!
So we went right down. I went right down to the car and I put my SB7. I said, why are you here? Is there something important in this car that you need? It said, yes.
Wow.
So, and let's be honest. There's a lot of people out there that absolutely love cars.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people out there that when they're driving their own car, they love it. So is it possible that the spirits are there because their car is there? I don't
know.
That
could be.
But a lot of these cars are like absolutely demolished. There's one car there and I'm going to probably do a little bit of investigation around it. Apparently if memory serves me correct from what John told me, a family died in the car. So I'm going to concentrate around in that area to see if we can pick up anything, but it's going to be interesting. So that's going to be my investigation for the Global Ghost Hunt.
Nice.
It's called McLean's Auto Wreckers, and there's got to be 10,000 cars And it's right. got to be 5 to 10 acres.
Wow.
Of property of just filled with cars, amazing. Trucks, everything. So
amazing.
It's going to be a lot of fun. And
right.
We are going to be recording it because okay. obviously I got to be here when the Global Ghost Hunt is on. So
yeah.
So we're going to be recording it, and I would prefer to record it than to go live, because honestly, the live, I've done a live there and the live was crap. It was very, very spotty. It kept on logging me out of StreamYard. So I decided that I'm going to do it. So we're doing the investigation on the 19th or 20th of April, okay. Depending on the weather. So if it's raining on the Friday, we're going to go on the Saturday. But if it's not raining, we're going to do it on the Friday night. So it's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be a great investigation. There's a lot going on in this place, and there's a lot of, it could be the new destination for a lot of paranormal investigators for this area.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
well, you said you can see spirits. I got a gift too. I can drink spirits.
What do you mean you can drink spirits?
I can drink spirits. This is just 7 Up, but
yeah. Okay. So today's video.
I don't drink that much. Okay. Let's do this.
Today's video, the Railroad Killer.
That sounds interesting.
Now, most people would pronounce it Angel, but I think he goes by Angle.
That's interesting.
And this guy was. See, this is what I don't understand about these. This guy was on the FBI list. He was 457th on the list. This guy killed 23 people. I think he should have been in the top 30, not 457.
But, hey, Dennis, if you're watching still.
But obviously, well, not obviously, but he was apprehended. And unfortunately he was executed by lethal injection in 2006. So, but this guy's a real sweetheart. And again, I go back to prior shows and saying, when there's abuse in the family, whether it's and this was his father and mother, they seem to have some real, real anger issues, eh?
Doesn't that always seem like it, though? I mean,
yeah. So,
hey, but this is amazing. You got a guy from this side of the ocean this time.
Yeah. Well, executed the day after my birthday.
Oh wow!
June 27th. My birthday is June 26th. And he was executed, like I said earlier, early 2006. So, early 2006, or died in 2006. So, yeah. So let's watch this video. This is a good one. I watched quite a bit more than I usually do, and this is a good one. So we're gonna learn a lot about this guy and what this guy was all about. He had some alias names too as well. And unfortunately, I will let people know, viewer discretion is advised on this one, for obvious reasons. Okay.
Right.
So here we go. Ready? Ready, Chris? And if you have anything to say, just tell me to stop and I'll stop the video. Okay.
Okay. I'll yell.
Okay. Well, you don't have to yell. But
I know.
Okay. Here we go.
In December 1998, a man slipped undetected into the home of 39-year-old Claudia Benton. By the time he fled the scene, the mother of two had been brutally beaten, sexually assaulted, and fatally stabbed.
Wow. He seemed to be almost ghost-like, the way he could get into houses without being heard. And, you know, ghosts scare people.
The killer was a man named Angel Resendez, who'd been illegally boarding trains across the U.S. border from Mexico for over 20 years. He would go on to kill at least 9 people, but the authorities couldn't find him anywhere.
There's 140,000 miles of track in North America. So how do you get your head around that? How do you find someone that's riding the rail?
Capturing right. the Phantom Killer would prove to be one of the FBI's toughest cases to crack. No one was safe.
You never really knew who was going to be the next victim. It was whoever had something that he wanted, and that could be anybody.
Hidden away for so long, Angel Resendez had emerged as one of the world's most evil killers. When Angel Resendez handed himself into US authorities in July 1999, it signaled the end of his reign of terror. The 38-year-old Mexican walked across the border and was never free again. For over 20 years, Resendez had been illegally crossing into the US, not by foot, but via the vast rail network. He'd murdered at least 9 people from Texas to Illinois. The media had dubbed him the Railroad Killer.
That's a stretch.
Detective Ken Maher helped crack the case that finally brought the elusive killer to justice.
He turned out to be very mobile. Extremely mobile. He was in one part of the country, and a few months later, he's in another part of the country.
Ken has his own theory behind Resendez's spate of murders.
In Mexico, he had a wife and a kid, and he's stealing jewelry from these women and then taking it to Mexico to sell it. So it was a business, pure and simple. The killing and the raping of the women before and after death was just sidekick. Just for fun.
This killer's story begins on the 1st of August, 1960. Angel Resendez was born in the state of Puebla in the east of Mexico.
Oh, okay.
Little is known about his childhood, but during his eventual trial, Resendez spoke to forensic psychologist Ramon Laval about his early years south of the border.
Angel Resendez grew up in a dysfunctional family. He didn't have a lot of connections with his family, siblings, or for that matter, his parents. Little or no contact with his biological father. He told me that he had grown up with his mother and father. In fact, upon further questioning, I realized he was talking about his maternal uncle, his mother's brother.
He felt rejected by his mother. He felt rejected by his peers at school because he was quite awkward looking. He had protruding teeth. He wasn't one of the cool kids. And I think those feelings stayed with him, and they really did go on to shape who he became.
Now, I'm not saying that unsettled childhood equals inevitably some kind of person who's going to turn to murder and serial killing. But I am saying in this particular case, that childhood gave Angel this sense that there was no one to depend on. He was the only person he could depend on.
Violence was a fixture in the young boy's life.
His uncle, whom he considered his father, was reported to have been physically abusive with Angel. And around 12, he quit school and he actually left his uncle's home, started living on the streets, just defending for himself. He was sexually molested by a local pedophile.
Like many violent offenders, Resendez was a victim before he was a criminal. And this is a line that we don't like to talk about very much. We like to compartmentalize.
And this is what I'm talking about, like the abuse, the sexual abuse. That always seems to be a catalyst on what's going to happen later in life with some of these people. I know there's a lot of people out there that don't, you know, they might have been through that and they don't turn to, you know, killing people or being violent towards people. So I always wonder why some people are like that and some people aren't. And I've always been told that, or I've always heard that it's something to do with the brain and what's going on in the brain. There's something missing in the brain that other people have use of and these people don't. So
that and abusing animals.
Well, yeah, the abusing animal goes along with it, right? So it's
that's what I mean, though. But it seems like one or the other or both always, it seems like.
Yeah, it just seems very, very interesting.
That cusp of adolescence and puberty. It's that moment when a young man, especially a young
about
man
from
such a troubled background, struggles out.
Is it gone? Can you see it?
And tries to
find I can see it.
Himself.
Yeah, okay.
Resendez took to illegally riding the far-reaching network of North American railroads. It was a transient lifestyle that would come to define him.
Resendez managed to travel quite far and wide within the United States by jumping on trains, jumping on an empty freight train and holing up in one of the carriages. And that would take him to a range of cities all over the place.
Because you could leap on it. It's a stuff of movies, isn't it? Slow-moving railroad car, and the hobo is standing by the track, and he grabs it and lifts himself up into an empty car.
It is thought that he first entered the United States when he was maybe 13 years old, and that's what he told me, that he was back and forth between Mexico and the United States. But in fact, the first record, formal record, is from when he was 16 years old, when he had entered and then deported.
After serving 5 years of a 20-year sentence in a U.S. prison for burglary, aggravated battery, and grand theft auto in 1980, continued to ride the rails. In fact, by August 1930, on no fewer than 7 occasions. But nothing deterred him, and his crimes would soon turn deadly.
One of the most complicated questions about Resendez in the first instance is why he started killing. He was getting by. Things were not easy. And he was being deported back and forth across the Mexican-US border on a regular basis. But that was no real reason in itself to kill. And one of the most fascinating aspects of Resendez's character is where that initial spark came from.
After illegally heading back north of the border on a train in the summer of 1997, Resendez carried out his first known murder in Lexington, Kentucky.
In August 1997, there was an attack on Christopher Meyer and Holly Dunn, who were a young couple. So he'd spotted this couple after he'd jumped off one of the freight trains that he'd ridden on. And I think his intention from the outset was to get to Holly Dunn and to sexually assault her. And in order to do that, he needed to get Christopher out of the way. And he killed him relatively quickly with a 50-pound rock, which must have been the most horrendous thing for Holly to witness and for Christopher to experience.
With her boyfriend taken care of, Resendez turned his attention to 20-year-old Holly Dunn.
She is terrified. Her hands are bound. She pleads with Resendez for her life. He sits down beside her and shows her an ice pick and says, look how easily I could kill you. But in the end, he doesn't kill her with an ice pick. In the end, he rapes her. It's impossible to imagine the terror she must have felt, because now Resendez goes away again and finds a wooden board and beats her mercilessly with it. Terrible injuries to her head, to her back, an attack so dramatic that he thought he'd killed her.
But miraculously, Holly Dunn had survived the brutal assault.
Holly Dunn, to her eternal credit, manages to struggle to her feet and literally walks away from the scene of the attack.
She's the only one to survive any attack from him, I was reading.
Thankfully, they called an ambulance and the police.
Resendez had got away with it for now and remained unknown to the authorities. But it was a mistake that would later come back to haunt the killer. By December 1998, the 38-year-old was regularly crossing the border into the USA. Border Patrol authorities had apprehended Resendez for illegal entry into the country 7 times in 1998 alone.
Wow.
Unaware he'd killed 21-year-old Christopher Meyer the previous year. But yeah. Now the killer was back on U.S. soil in Houston, Texas, and had murder on his mind.
That day in particular was a Thursday, December 17th. And they, like most any other day, the afternoon was uneventful. I left for work around 3:30 and picked my son up at the sitter. It was his 9th birthday. And I picked him up, and on the way home, I got a call from the dispatcher at West University Place saying, we've got a body, a dead body. And I had chills and goosebumps thinking, it just can't be. It's got to be something else. It just got to be something else. But she assured me that, yes, there was indeed, patrol officers had discovered a deceased female.
The murdered woman was 39-year-old research physician Dr. Claudia Benton. She'd been home alone. Ken walked into a horrific scene.
There was a bloody butcher knife on a pillow next to her head, blood all over the carpet, blood on the bed, blood in the hallway leading just out the threshold of the bedroom door. Overall, it appeared every room in the house had been rummaged, ransacked, drawers open. Everything appeared to be touched and looked through.
Dr. Benton had been stabbed to death with a knife from her own kitchen. There were 3 fatal wounds on her body.
In addition to that, she had 19 skull fractures from being beat upon the head. I can only surmise that some of them may have been from the bronze figurine. It was probably maybe about a foot in length that had been on the mantelpiece. Quite heavy. Part of it was broken off during the beating.
It was a savage and brutal murder of a wife and mother of twin girls.
I think there is an inherent misogyny to Resendez. There is an inherent hatred of women, which I think goes back to his rather dysfunctional relationship with his mother. So he thinks that women are there to provide something for him, to give something to him. He feels entitled to take that.
Further investigation at the home suggested that Dr. Benton had been literally fighting for her life.
Dr. Benton had a complete fracture to her ulna and dislocated elbow as well. And so she put up a very, very fierce fight. From the blood in the hallway, it looks like she was very, very close to trying to escape from the bedroom and get away from him. But being hit so many times in the head already, he was just able to physically overpower her and subdue her.
After analyzing the bloody crime scene, Ken had to make one of the most difficult phone calls of his professional career to Dr. Benton's husband, George.
Very, very difficult talking to the man because here I am, I'm having to explain to him that there's a dead body in his house, and he's telling me the only person that should be in there was his wife. And I felt sick, felt really, really sick inside because I'm thinking to myself, I mean, what if that was me? So I tried to be as gentle as possible. I tried to give him every avenue out. Could it have been a nanny? Could it have been a maid? Anybody else? And he just kept telling me, no, it's just my wife's the only one that would be in there.
While Ken took Dr. Benton's devastated husband on a somber tour of the crime scene, he helped to point out anything that was out of the ordinary around the house.
It was actually George Benton that noticed the steering column housing in the garage. He looked at it and said, that's got to be from the Jeep.
The killer had made his getaway in Dr. Benton's vehicle, but he'd failed to find the keys that were hanging up in a kitchen cupboard.
The next best thing he had to do was to try to hotwire the car. He knew he had to pop the steering column off, and so he did that. In doing so, he stuck his fingers in there to pry it out, and then he just set that into the garage. That was some of the best evidence that we had
right there.
Were his 4 fingerprints on the underside of that piece of plastic.
So not the smartest
person. This would become a crucial piece of evidence in the future trial of Angel Resendez. Lynn McClellan was an assistant district attorney who would eventually help to bring charges against the killer.
Cars recovered in San Antonio. His fingerprints are found on the car. The car belongs to Claudia Benton. That kind of ties everything back. What's her car doing in San Antonio with Lucinda's prints on it, and she's found dead back in Houston. So put two and two together, you say he's probably the one who killed her.
A week after the murder of Claudia Benton, Ken had a major breakthrough. For the first time, Angel Resendiz would become known to the homicide detective, albeit under a different name.
It was the day after Christmas. I'd received a call from a sergeant with the Houston PD. He had received information from their fingerprint division. We had an identification of the perpetrator. Fingerprints came back to an individual named Carlos Cluthier Rodriguez, one of his numerous aliases that he was arrested under. So his prints were in the automated fingerprint identification system in Texas under that name.
Treat yourself to the best gift in history this holiday season. Enjoy unlimited access to award-winning...
Diz had used many different aliases, which made it difficult for the authorities to link him to his numerous misdemeanors through the years.
Every time he was arrested, it seemed to give a different name. I mean, Resendiz is what we finally kind of settled on in terms of a name, but he had used so many names in the past. So we knew he had fingerprint identification at that time. We knew who he was. We had pictures. And so we were slowly able to get these pictures out into the media and try to generate some tips and leads and so forth.
The hunt for Resendiz continued for over 3 months, but the killer remained elusive. By the spring of 1999, he was back in Texas, this time in the small city of Weimar. On the night of April the 30th, he entered the home of Norman and Karen Cernick.
The Cernicks were both asleep in their bed. From the evidence that was found, Mr. Cernick was laying on his left side, and the blow to the head with the sledgehammer woke up Mrs. Cernick. She sits up in bed, and Resendiz takes the sledgehammer left-handed like a baseball bat and strikes her square in the forehead, killing her instantly. He then goes back and hits Mr. Cernick one more time with the sledgehammer for good measure.
Resendiz had bludgeoned the church pastor and his wife to death. It was a vicious double murder by the seemingly opportunistic killer.
Resendiz was not an offender who would take weapons along with him to the crime scene. He would use whatever he could find that was there. He would decide to kill when he saw the opportunity to do so. There is an advantage to this as an offender, because if you're not carrying weapons around with you, then you're not carrying evidence around with you.
The escalation in Dr. Benton's case, he hit her with a smaller figurine and she fought back. This case with the Cernicks in Weimar, there was no fighting back. He made sure with that first blow, but he didn't want to fight. He had enough fighting the last time.
Evidence at the crime scene linked the Cernick murders to the killing of Dr. Claudia Benton.
They collected, of course, very good DNA evidence from the Weimar case. That was sent to Department of Public Safety Laboratories, and DNA testing was done. And it was an exact match to our perpetrator in our case.
With at least three confirmed murders on his macabre resume, the FBI entered the search for the man who would later be given the moniker the Railroad Killer. Angel Resendiz, however, continued to use various aliases, so tracking him down wasn't going to be straightforward. Special Agent Bobby Knox Eckerd was part of the team assigned to the case.
There's 140,000 miles of track in North America. So how do you get your head around that? How do you find someone that's riding the rail? So what you do is you go in, you meet with the seven major railroad companies. They all have agents that work for them. They have railroad police. So they started pulling all of his records, and he had dozens of trespass records on the railroad.
The crimes that Resendez committed had a significant impact, especially on those living by railway tracks, because there wasn't a specific victim type. You never really knew who was going to be the next victim. It was whoever had something that he wanted, and that could be anybody. So the level of fear, the level of anxiety that his crimes generated was horrendous.
Not long after the FBI's involvement in the case, they were able to link the unsolved murder of Christopher Meyer almost 2 years earlier to Resendez.
We received a hit from 1997 where a couple was brutalized. The male was killed. The female was the only survivor of Resendez, and that was in Kentucky near railroad tracks. Through DNA, through eyewitness testimony of the survivor, and through a sketch that she was able to give to the officers there, we were pretty sure it was the same person. Once the DNA came back, it was a positive hit. So now we had him responsible for at least 4 homicides.
At that point, we knew we had a serious, serious killer on the loose.
But Angel Resendez was only just getting started, and there would soon be even more victims. By late May 1999, authorities across the U.S. were desperately searching for a man they now knew was a serial killer. The 38-year-old Mexican had been linked to at least 4 murders, 3 of them in Texas in the previous 5 months. The so-called railroad killer was headline news across the Lone Star State.
Resendez is attracting growing notoriety in Texas. Inevitably, it feeds the vanity that has been growing inside him. He knows people are beginning to look for him, and yet he still feels he can get away with it. In fact, he was to kill again.
On June the 3rd, Resendez was back in Houston, and his bloodlust had become insatiable. Under the veil of night, he entered the home of 26-year-old Noemi Dominguez.
Noemi is an elementary school teacher. She is at home, and he breaks in, picks up a pickaxe-like tool, and attacks her. By now, Resendez is quite clearly out of control. Any sense of order, of civilization, of propriety is gone. He is now literally like an animal lusting for blood with blood dripping from him. Again, she's sexually assaulted, and again, he kills her.
She lived near railroad tracks. Her body was covered up. Almost looked very similar to the way Dr. Benton was covered up. The legs sticking out from underneath the covers. She was face down, and she had been beaten to death.
Resendez.
So it is suggested, if you're planning to buy or live, and you see, and you're planning to move, where, whether it's an apartment, well, I guess you can get away with apartment, but if you're planning to move and it's going to be a house and it's near the railroad tracks, leave that house right away.
I lived across during the same time frame. I lived across the street from railroad tracks.
Oh yeah, there you go.
I wasn't afraid at the time. The railroad tracks. I know, but yeah. Now I'm looking back and I was like, Jesus, he could have easily jumped off and killed me and my roommate.
Oh, wow, that's funny. Well, right? I guess it's really not that funny, but.
Survived, so looking back on it, yeah.
for sure. But it looked like he was just mainly staying in Texas and Kentucky. That's where it seemed that's where he was doing most of it,
yeah. Killing.
Yeah.
Then he went all the way up to Canada.
Cover some of his victims with
What's that?
It said, let me see if I can find it. It said something about Canada. Illegally jumping off trains with in and across Mexico, Canada, and the United States, he was able to get evade authorities for a long time.
Even Canada?
So he, not saying he did anything up there, but it's just saying he was jumping trains. So maybe he'd like, you know, like Kentucky up to Canada to like mess with people and then come down.
Maybe they'll mention something in this video about that.
Yeah. I mean, that's on Wikipedia too. So
yeah. Yeah.
Kids, because this essentially dehumanizes them, it depersonalizes them, but also it's about looking, it's about seeing and being seen. So he's covering his victims because he doesn't want to look at them, but he also doesn't want them to look at him. So it's this constant theme of shame that comes up time and time again.
As the killer grew more experienced, he became more brazen in his actions. Resendez had started leaving calling cards at the scene of his murders.
When he murdered the victims, he would find their ID, driver's license or some other type of ID, and would display them in such fashion that whoever entered the home later would find out who they were, how they looked like. In my mind, he wanted to see how they looked like before he bludgeoned them to death, before he raped them, and see what it would have been, almost as if he had already developed a relationship with the victim.
After killing Noemi Dominguez, Resendez wasn't finished. Just as he'd done after murdering Claudia Benton, he stole the schoolteacher's car and headed 100 miles west.
It was a white Honda, and it was taken and driven to Fayette County near Schulenburg, small community of Dubina, where he then murdered Josephine Konvichko. He toyed with law enforcement at that scene by displaying a toy train, displaying newspaper articles about the cases, the murders.
This is like reading an article that says, I am the railroad killer, and I'm leaving this here for you to know and make sure that you know it is me, nobody else. I am the railroad killer. He was proud of that.
It is yet further proof, if anyone needed, that he is now utterly out of control and glorying in every moment of his celebrity. It is one of the most troubling of moments when a killer starts to live up to his own hype, who becomes obsessed with his own fame.
Resendez had killed 73-year-old Josephine Konvichko with the same pickaxe he'd used just hours before when murdering Noemi Dominguez.
When he left the premises, he'd actually left the pickaxe in Josephine's head and he tucked her up in bed, which was quite a bizarre kind of behavior. But he'd left behind a really important piece of evidence, because on that pickaxe was some of Noemi Dominguez's blood. So those two murders were connected.
Less than 2 weeks later, Resendez had traveled far from Texas, over 800 miles north to Illinois. On June the 15th, 1999, he committed another double murder. The victims were 79-year-old George Morber and his 51-year-old daughter, Carolyn Frederick. George's home in the quiet village of Gorham was less than 100 yards from the railroad.
In Illinois, he found a shotgun. The elderly gentleman was in his easy chair reading his newspaper. Resendez is able to gain entry into the house, ties him up with telephone cord, ties him to his easy chair, gets behind him with a 12-gauge shotgun and shoots him in the back of the head through the back seat of the recliner. A little while later, his daughter comes in and she is immediately beat to death with the 12-gauge shotgun.
Wow.
You know what? We've done a lot of bad people in the past, but this guy's right up there as one of the worst.
I was just chuckling. I don't know if you saw that. I was thinking you couldn't tie somebody up with phone cord anymore. No one has phone cord.
Jeez. Like, wow.
But Jesus, he just didn't care at all. And he was so random.
The father and daughter took the tally of known victims to 8. Authorities were becoming desperate to capture the elusive railroad killer.
He seemed to be almost ghost-like, the way he could get into houses without being heard, without disturbing the occupants. And that was one of the strangest things. I still don't know how he got into Dr. Benton's house and all the other houses. And that was a scary part. And ghosts scare people. It's just a natural reaction to something that can't be explained, and the way he was able to enter people's homes couldn't be explained.
The killings were becoming more frequent, and the hunting ground had become wider spread. The FBI immediately took action.
On June 21st of 1999, working with our FBI headquarters, we were able to add Resendez to our top 10 most wanted fugitives. When anyone has made a top 10, both the media and the public are made aware of how important this case was. The media helped us immensely in this case. Everybody in the United States and in Mexico, to a certain extent, wanted this guy captured. He had turned from a serial killer, now he was a spree killer. And I think everybody in the world wanted him caught.
The addition of Resendez to the most wanted list brought nationwide TV exposure.
So that's when the tips were coming in. And as the tips came in, anything that was really, really helpful, that sounded legitimate, was funneled to the task force. And it was just a huge coordinated effort in trying to find this guy.
I don't know if it was the media or the FBI, but he was given the name the Railroad Killer. And in every media blitz, you would see the Railroad Killer is on the run again. He's been here, he's been there, he's committed this crime.
The national exposure put pressure on the family and friends of Angel Resendez across the Mexican border.
This was the most complex case most of us had ever worked because the jurisdiction was huge. It was all the way in North America. You know, you just didn't know where he was going to be. Once we identified he had a wife or a common-law wife in Mexico was the pivotal point for me.
Resendez's wife was brought across the border to be questioned by the FBI. Bobby led the interview.
She was brought up here. She brought her daughter, who was approximately 3 or 4 months old, and we conducted the interview over a two-day period. During that interview, I was able to provide her with enough information that she came to believe that he had committed the homicides. We showed her the DNA, we showed her fingerprints. We asked her if she had ever received anything from his trips into the U.S. After her visit here, the U.S. Marshals, the Texas Rangers, went back down into her village, and she provided everything that he had ever given her that she still had in her possessions, and they were, in fact, stolen at the crime scenes.
Resendez remained in hiding, but the authorities were doing all they could to flush him out.
Once you take away all their comfort zones, they have nowhere to go, and they generally make mistakes, and you'll be able to apprehend them that way.
The tactics worked. With nowhere to run to, a sister of Angel Resendez convinced the killer to turn himself over to the U.S. investigators.
We had one sister who lived in New Mexico that would prove to be the person that negotiated surrender, that Texas Ranger developed trust with this individual. And through that development, she ended up contacting him and arranged a surrender.
And then it was his brother who accompanied him when he turned himself to the Texas Ranger in El Paso, the crossing between Mexico and the United States by the Rio Grande.
Now, this is something straight out of a movie. It really does have a lot of dramatic effect. And I think that is very revealing about Resendez. He's the director in his own drama. He is calling the shots. He's in control.
After hunting the railroad killer for nearly 7 months, Detective Ken Maher was stunned when Resendez gave up the ghost.
I'm amazed that he did it. All he had to do was just stay in Mexico and then come across on a train or come across the border whenever he wanted to and commit more murders and keep up his little side business of selling jewelry in Mexico and live happily ever with his wife and kid. I'm grateful that he turned himself in. To this day, still I'll never know the real motive. I think he was maybe a bit concerned about his wife and daughter in Mexico being harmed, if there were some bounties on his head.
Soon after the capture of Resendez, Ken found himself face to face with the serial murderer. After speaking to so many potential suspects over the previous few months, There was one thing in particular that Ken was looking for, to make sure they definitely got their man.
There were many times that my partner, Joey Sanders, and I would just get a friend to call front at the police department, sometimes transferred from Houston PD, saying that the people swear they've seen Resendez in some part of Houston. And one of the first things we do is grab his right hand, look at the ring finger, and if it didn't have a scar, even though it looked like him, we knew it wasn't him, because it showed up on every fingerprint card that he had. It was an extremely noticeable scar just straight through the pad of his ring finger. Sure enough, when we caught him, it's one of the first things I was able to do, I think. And sure enough, it was there. It was true to life.
Resendez may have surrendered himself to the police, but there was no way this was going to be an open and shut case for prosecutors. With a trial looming, defense attorneys were going to tell the judge that the killer was insane. By now, investigators were aware that he'd killed 8 people and were still looking into whether there may be even more. The unsolved murder of an 87-year-old woman named Leafy Mason in Hugh Springs, Texas, was high on their list of potential victims.
At one of the task force meetings, we had a police officer from Hughes Springs, where Leafy Mason was murdered. They took out the complete window frame where the suspect in their case made entry, and they preserved it as evidence. And sure enough, they matched up his fingerprints. Resendez, there he was. So we had a good match to that case as well.
Resendez had bludgeoned the 87-year-old woman to death with a flat iron in October 1998, 2 months before the killing of Dr. Claudia Benton. Leafy Mason became the 9th known victim of Angel Resendez, but it's believed the total number of people who died at the hands of the railroad killer is even higher.
He confessed to 12 or 13 crimes, and they were able to confirm through DNA evidence that he had, in fact, committed those crimes.
The killer talked about his many possible victims with forensic psychologist Ramon Laval.
We didn't discuss the full chronology on what came first and second, third, fourth, but I have an idea that it started, as far as we know, in 86.
Ramon had been asked to evaluate the mental state of Angel Resendez after a judge informed the defense attorneys that the killer would be prevented from pleading not guilty by reason of insanity unless he was assessed by an independent psychologist.
He was not only willing to admit culpability, he talked about them. He said, yeah, he was the actor. He was the one who perpetrated them. And he would not be willing to give anybody else credit. He was very narcissistic, very self-absorbed. His manner of communication about the crimes was very calm, emotionally collected. He did not display any extreme emotional feelings about them. No sorrow, no regret.
Despite admitting to many murders, the prosecution only needed Resendez to be found guilty of one. So they had to find the most airtight case against him, the murder of Dr. Claudia Benton.
We had the strongest case by far. I think some of the other counties might have wanted to have had their own trial and convict him. But once he's convicted of capital murder in Texas, there's not much need to do it again.
Assistant District Attorney Lynn McClellan was part of the prosecution team.
In every criminal case, you have to prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt. So it's really just proving the elements of that crime. The evidence that who did it came from his fingerprints, you know, in Claudia Benton's case, and fingerprints in the apartment, fingerprints on the car that was recovered in San Antonio afterwards. So that's really not a real difficult case to prove because all the evidence is there. Fingerprints and DNA are much better than eyewitness because eyewitnesses can make mistakes and fingerprints and DNA are not.
The trial began on May the 8th, 2000 in Houston, Texas. Ken Maha was in the courtroom.
One thing that stuck out immensely was the amount of weight that Resendez gained. He looked like a completely different person. He must have put on 40 to 50 pounds, maybe even more. He was quiet, didn't say a word. I don't believe he said one single word throughout the trial, unless he was conversing with his attorneys.
As expected, the defense attorneys claimed that 39-year-old Resendez was not guilty by reason of insanity.
They say he's schizophrenic. They say he's any kind of a mental disease. Did that cause him to do it? Did he know right from wrong? Obviously, he knew right from wrong because he was trying to get away, and he got away. I mean, there are lots of people that have mental diseases. They don't all go around killing people.
Before the trial, Resendez had been quoted in the media calling himself an angel of God. But Ramon Laval didn't agree with the killer's theory.
My main concern was if he was insane at the time of the offense, and if he was doing the will of God, where did the rape come from? He could not quite explain that. He was like, huh, I wonder why you're asking me that question. You know, I hadn't quite thought about that.
So basically, it's almost a confession that I did this. But when I did this, I didn't know right from wrong. I didn't know what I was doing. And thus, I can't be held legally responsible. I get a get-out-of-jail-free card because I didn't know right from wrong.
Ramon's testimony put the idea that Resendez was insane firmly to bed.
My conclusions at the end were, despite his expression of delusions, statements that had a very delusional flavor, I came to believe that he was not insane and that he was just smart and manipulative and knew how to use information.
As a final nail in the coffin, prosecutors called Holly Dunn to the stand. The testimony of the girl who cheated death at the hands of Resendez in Kentucky 3 years previously left the jury in no doubt. On May the 18th, 2000, Angel Resendez was found guilty of the murder of Dr. Claudia Benton. 4 days later, he was sentenced to death.
I knew that the verdict was going to be guilty. There was really no defense put up. When he was sentenced to death, I was happy. To me, it was the appropriate punishment. Not to get into any of the debates about death penalty, right or wrong. In Texas, that was a punishment, and that's what he got.
Resendez was on death row for 6 years before his stay of execution came to an end. On June the 27th, 2006, FBI Special Agent Bobby Knox Eckerd went to Huntsville, Texas, to witness the death of the railroad killer firsthand.
He's brought in, he jumped up on the table, they prepare him, and they allow him to make a statement. In this case, he apologized to the victims, but he then kind of claimed that the devil made him do it. He said it was my fault because I let the devil into my life, but the devil was responsible. And the drugs were administered at that point. And the very last thing he was asking in Spanish for forgiveness from God. And then he died very peacefully. I felt no joy in the fact that he had been executed. I felt nothing towards him other than anger for what he had done to the victims and what he left the victims' families to deal with for the rest of their lives. He was gone, but they still are here having to deal with his crimes.
What Claudia Benton's husband said probably sums it up. He was evil contained in human form. Creature without a soul, no conscience, no sense of remorse, no regard for the sanctity of life. Because with Resendez, it's all about him. He's the one in charge. He's the one he's trying to satisfy. He went through his whole life, you know, thinking he had the right to do all these things, and whatever he wanted to do, he did it because he was the one in charge.
After taking the lives of so many others, 45-year-old Angel Resendez had himself been put to death. He is no longer a danger to innocent people.
He was probably the most evil person that I ever was involved in the investigation. And I've investigated lots of murders, child molesters, kidnappers, but I think this guy was inherently evil.
He's just a savage animal, absolute savage animal. The way he dealt with his victims, it was just completely savage.
Ángel Resendez spent his entire life in the shadows of society. Holed up in freight train carriages across America, he was able to carry out his crimes completely undetected. Why he started raping and killing the victims of his burglaries, we shall never know. But the amount of people he slayed suggests that he enjoyed the act of murder and proves that Ángel Resendez is one of the world's most evil killers.
He is. He definitely is.
Yeah, let me just remove this. Yeah. I was reading, and I'm sure you saw it too, but there was actually something about 23 murders.
Yeah. So I think they just covered the main ones. And...
Well, they said, I guess he was nailed for 9, but then they suspected he did 3 or 4 more. But where's the 23 come from?
Yeah.
Maybe they found out later on down the road that he was associated with a lot more. But this guy was... as I always say, crazy.
Yeah.
he was really crazy. Yeah.
No rhyme or reason. Like I said, he could have been riding by my house. Oh, I like that he just carried in a pizza. I'm going to go fucking whack Chris in the head. You know,
yeah, it's weird. It's weird. It's just, there's, you know, even with that doctor that was, one that, was examining him, you think he might've said something to him that the reason why he was doing it, but he never really gave any kind of reason. I guess he just hated people.
I know. I mean, yeah, it's just weird. No rhyme, no reason.
There wasn't somebody like with, obviously with some serial killers, there's a specific reason why they're going after them. But it's just,
like their prom date turned them down and was blonde haired, so now they kill all blonde people. Or
well, whatever the
have a reason.
He had no reason whatsoever, which is which is odd. But and unfortunately, it's something. Unfortunately, with him being dead now, it's something we'll never know. But one. I have to say, he is one of the worst people that we've done on this show so far.
Yeah,
and we've done some doozies.
This one on Wikipedia.
Go ahead.
I saw on Wikipedia it showing his first death, he shot somebody 4 times with .38 caliber and then put her in an abandoned farmhouse.
Yeah.
It's shown that as the first one.
I still think Harold Shipman is probably one of the worst serial killers in history. And even though he's 5th or 6th on the list, but yeah. I still don't understand why he's not number one. I guess that also maybe, being number one, you have to have, maybe all of them have to be confirmed cases. Now it's suspected that he killed over 250 people.
Yeah.
But, that hasn't been confirmed. So maybe that's what it's all about. Maybe, confirmed cases. And that's why they're
so do you think maybe killing got easier for these people as they go on, like the first one, they're kind of like, oh crap. And then they just get like, yeah.
I would hate this. I hate it. Like that's even.
I know that's deeply psychological,
it is. And I'm just wondering, because we have heard in certain cases over this show that we've done that it did get easier for them.
Yeah.
And I guess the first one is, well, what they say is the first one is the very, it is the toughest to get over, but apparently this guy had no issues and a lot of other serial murderers.
Well, that's what I'm saying. And how he just broke into houses too, with no, I mean, like they said, he was so quiet and stuff. That's amazing too. I mean, every house, I have broken into a few houses, but not like that, but just, you know, like, lock the keys in or whatever. But
like what, Chris? Like what?
You lock the keys in the house or...
Yeah, I got you.
But, yeah.
Well, I definitely
there's always noise.
You know, it's interesting, and
this guy was
these cases as we go on with a lot of these cases, they get more and more interesting and more puzzling. But I do want to apologize to you and for the people that were watching and the people going to be watching the replay that that happened tonight. But
right,
regarding next week's show, I'm hoping we're not going to be showing a video. I'm hoping to have a guest. I'm going to be speaking to him this week. I'm hoping that he's going to come on. It is a judge.
Ooh.
So we have spoken, and he's a judge now. But originally, when he first got into, I guess, law, he was a defense attorney. So, and he was a very, very well-known defense attorney here in Canada. And now he stepped up to a judge. Now he's a civil judge, but he did deal with, you know, these type of people. And we're hopefully we're going to have him on the show next week. But if not, he will be coming up sometime soon. So I'm looking forward to talking to him. He's a friend. He is a friend of mine. So
nice.
Yeah. What were you going to say?
So like they were talking about the wanted posters being hung up. Like, you know what I mean? Like the top 10 wanted posters.
Yeah.
I remember them always being like in our post office and like, do they do that up in Canada too? I know that's kind of a dumb question, but do they do that up in Canada too? Like,
no, I don't think they do. And to be perfectly honest, I don't really go to the post office that much.
Right. So, okay. We got a P.O. box, but we don't do it anymore here. I don't see them anymore.
Oh, okay.
But
okay.
When I was little, I just remember always seeing them up there, and I'm always like, why you got me looking for this guy? I mean.
Yeah. But I want to thank you for filling in for AJ. It was very, very short notice. It was like literally 8 minutes before the show.
Right. And, I just had to get my drink. You're welcome.
I
want to
thank you for filling in for him. And hopefully we'll see. Oh, great. So if I ever need you, I'll just do it 5 minutes before the show. Say, Chris, I need you.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's always at this time. So usually I'm home unless, you know.
Yeah.
I'm coming to the Super Bowl party or something. I'll definitely.
Yeah, there you go. Hopefully AJ gets better and we'll see him.
Definitely get well, AJ. Get well.
Yeah, we'll see him next week. And also he needs to get better because over the next few days, we're going to be doing the schedule for the Global Ghost Hunt for all the teams. So that should be coming out sometime this week.
So, I'll watch for it.
Yeah. And we got promo videos coming out for all the teams coming out in the next couple of days.
Awesome.
And so look out for those. But other than that, thank you again. And I want to thank everybody that came into the room today. And hopefully you have a good week and we will see you next week. Okay.
Awesome. Thank you guys. Okay. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you. Thank you, Chris. See everybody next week.
Have a good one, everybody.